Your name?
My name is Roland Dill.
And Dr. Dill, where were you born?
I was born on a farm about 2 miles from Dassel, Minnesota, in September of 1924.
And just where is Dassel?
Dassel is 50 miles straight west of Minneapolis, 35 miles south of St. Cloud.
Is it a big town at that time?
Town then of about 680 people.
Who were your parents and what did they do?
My parents, my father was a farmer and my mother was a housewife, as those things went. He'd been born 8 miles south of Dassel and she'd been born 9 miles north of Dassel, which meant I grew up with lots of relatives. And my father was very interested in politics of a sort. He was on the town board, the school board, county commissioner for 8 years, back on the town board. My mother was on the town board. I thought she was the first woman in Minnesota on a town board, but she wasn't. We had a neighbor who was. She was appointed when my father got elected county commissioner. She was appointed by the board as a member of the town board. We went to church in town and went to school in town.
And did you complete high school in Dassel?
I graduated in Dassel High School on, it must have been May 1942. I'd gone all through school there, starting in a small class in kindergarten. There were 13 of us. Finally graduated with a class of 38, because, of course, in the ninth grade, lots of kids came into the country schools.
Did you go on to college from there?
Yes, let me go back a bit and point out that I started my senior year in September 1941, and it was in December then that Pearl Harbor came. And we all knew that we were slated, but we didn't know when. So we went ahead with our plans. I graduated, and my friends and I decided to go to the University of Minnesota, which we did. We started then in September 1942 at the University of Minnesota.
And were you drafted eventually, or did you
Yes,
elect?
Yes. They were drafting people from the ages of 19 to, I think, 35 or 36, eventually at the age of 38. No 18-year-olds were drafted. And then at Christmas, when I was a freshman at college, we had to register for the draft if we were 18, and thereafter anybody 18 years old would register for the draft. I registered for the draft at Christmas vacation. Went back to the University of Minnesota, and I was called up in the first part of May, before the end of the semester, but I got grades for all my courses, and finally went in. Well, on Memorial Day, 1942, I went into the Army.
So you got 1 year in of college.
Right.
Then went into the Army.
Right.
Could you have chosen the branch that you served in, or were you...
Well, one of my best friends and I went down the same day. He took the Navy and I took the Army.
Okay. So you did have a say.
Right. By that time, of course, several of my friends had volunteered in various ways. At least three of them had volunteered for the Air Force. That's where we got sure of getting into the Air Force by volunteering. And my one of my two roommates got into a Navy program, which kept him in college until the guys agreed that he was commissioned after that.
Where did you go for your military training?
I had in April or something like that, taken a test that anyone can take. If you got a certain level of a certain grade, you would be eligible to go to a program in either the Navy or the Army, depending on what you were in. It's called the Army Specialized Training Program. So I assumed that's where I'd be going eventually. So after we left Fort Snelling on the 13th of June, 1942. We went down to Fort Riley, Kansas, where we did our basic training. 13 weeks, went a little longer than that. And everybody in that battalion, which was part of the cavalry, although we didn't have any horses, we were just taking our training under cavalry officers who were among the most... They were very beautiful people with their shiny boots and their army or their horse riding trousers. and very tough, and we had a good basic training. Then some of the people who had thought they were going on to college were not allowed to, because the first day in the Army we took what's called the Army IQ test. And if you didn't do very well in that, then you really couldn't go on to college. So I lost some of my friends there. But we went then to the University of Nebraska, getting there in the middle of September 1943.
Any special memories of the military training?
Well, yes, I have a lot of memories. It was interesting, of course, everybody in the battalion, if that's what they called it, in the cavalry, I don't remember, but everybody in our troop, who I knew well, 200 and some, had been in college, was going to go on to college. They were from all over. It was a pretty exciting thing to meet so many people, because in the 30s we didn't travel very much. We didn't have the money, and it wasn't the sort of thing you did. So getting to know a great number of people, a lot of places, was kind of important to me. I went to see a baseball game. The Army, the Fort Riley team played a game. I went to see it. And one of the fielders was a fellow named Pete Breezer, who had been one of my heroes. He had been one of the leaders for the Brooklyn Dodgers, who won the pennant 2 years earlier. One day, walking down the street from a movie, we noticed that there was a boxing match going on. There were a lot of very small people in Fort Riley, because they're Hispanic, from Texas. They knew about horses. And they also, I suppose, were aiming to use them in some less than exciting effort, training barns and so on. That's the way the Army was. There were also a lot of what we then call Negro troops. Well, walking by this vacant area, I noticed a fight going on, so I stopped and watched it. It was a couple of very lightweight boxers, featherweights probably. But the exciting thing about it was the referee was Joe Lewis, who was stationed at Fort Riley. And later on that summer, we had a party, a beer bus, they called it. I was from Dassel and didn't drink, but I'd gone to a movie, which we hadn't done in Dassel either. But I came over afterwards, and there was a civilian there. So he was talking baseball, so we all talked baseball. And I was never a baseball player. I was a basketball player, but not baseball. But it's something I always wanted to be. So I did what many people did. I became a kind of a scholar of the game. In a way, I knew everybody's batting average and all sorts of things. Uh-huh. Read a lot of books about baseball. So I'm sure that as I think back, I had a lot to say. And I probably even told the guy some things I thought he ought to know. But then he walked away, and I said, "Who is that?" "Well, that's Ty Cobb," who at that time may have been, we thought, looking down the path, the greatest ball player who ever lived. I hope I didn't tell him how to slide into third. It was said that he left scars on 2,000 third baseman in his lifetime. Those are the things I remember. I remember some really great people that I got to know. And then we all went off to Nebraska.
And how long were you in Nebraska?
Well, I took the... I was put into the second class because I'd already had a lot of college courses. But a lot of people had, but I did freshman English, but I hadn't had much math. Finished the first quarter at Christmas time, then started the second one, and early in January they announced that the program was going to fold. It was quite clear to the Army, though not to us, that we were going to win the war and we were going to win it fairly soon. Who would have thought that? We didn't, but anyway, they were going to close it down. They said the war will be over with before we graduate. We need to have somebody to invade Europe.
How could they determine it was going to be such a fast war?
Well, you remember the war started in 1941. By May of 1942, we essentially destroyed the Japanese fleet. It was going to take a long time, but nothing was going to stop us. June of 41, before Pearl Harbor, the Germans had invaded Russia. And about the time of Pearl Harbor, they come against Moscow and hadn't made it. And it was quite clear that Russia would eventually triumph. And England had held out all by itself for so long, and we were coming to their, to be their partners. So we had the great miracle of the war was obviously we converted to wartime industry. We were turning out airplanes, tanks, everything that needed. So we were told that was it. But if you were going to be a doctor or a dentist or an interpreter, you could stay in. And that so happened I had an acceptance to dental school, largely because my sister-in-law was the secretary of the dean of dental school at the University of Minnesota. And I had good grades as a freshman, so I had an acceptance set up. So if I completed the required courses, I would be accepted to dental school. So I walked around that night, pocket for a week, and then finally threw it away and decided I got to choose between being a dentist and invading Europe. I guess I'm for Europe. I wish I could pass it off as a matter of courage or whatnot. It was just the feeling that that was our war. I wanted to be in it. I didn't want to be a dentist either. It had been a really very interesting 6 months because we were all allowed in the basis of test scores, which didn't necessarily seem to make good engineers. So there were quite a few fellows who were no more engineering material than I was. And in my own particular platoon, that's not what they called it, the 25 people, there were seven of us who were really very much interested in literature. And they convinced me one ought to give one's life to literature. Be a poet if you can, be a novelist if you can't be a poet, if you can't be either of them, be a scholar and a teacher. So, of those seven, four became doctors.
That's terrific.
And one who died about 3 years ago became probably the most distinguished student of constitutional history in the United States. He was a Regents Professor at the University of Minnesota. And the other one, besides me, died in the war, and then there was me. I went into English.
So, where did you go after your schooling in Nebraska?
We were shipped down, as were, see, there were a lot of these programs, and from a lot of places, we were shipped down to Camp Robinson in Arkansas, just outside of Little Rock. We arrived, got off the train, it was raining, and the sergeant who has lined up kept there staying for 2 hours, saying, "We'll teach you, college boys, what it's like to be in the Army." And then we went into our various companies. I joined the, I had found that I was a member of the 66th Black Panther Division. And it was a rather unusual thing because that division had begun in June the previous year. They'd gone through basic training, gone through maneuvers, and then bam, the invasion was coming up. They took every private out of the division and sent them overseas, leaving the officers and the non-commissioned officers there, and we came in. Well, they were awfully close friends of the ones who had left, and there was initial some dislike for us, especially since none of them had gone to college, and all of us had gone for a couple of years of college. But we soon found out that that didn't make any difference. And they tried to work us too hard, but they didn't realize we'd had physical training under some real experts at the University of Nebraska every day for 6 months, and we were in pretty good shape. But the wetness and the terrible heat in our cabin, because of the fellow, there, one fellow living there, and he insisted on keeping the heat way up, sent me to the hospital. And they took a blood test and lost it, took another one and lost it. I said, "I got mononucleosis," which I'd had the previous year. They said, "No, that's not it." Well, then the division got orders to move out, and my captain came to see me. And he said, "We can leave you, or we can take you along if you are willing to leave the hospital early." I said, "I want to go on." They had another blood test to take, and they hadn't come back yet, but they let me out. And they were very good to me. I didn't have to go to work for a while. what was then called Camp Rucker, Alabama. Now it's Fort Rucker in the center of our helicopter army services. Then it was just another army camp.
And how long were you in Alabama?
Let's see, we got there after about a month in Arkansas. We got there then sometime in April. And we were there long enough then to get our furloughs. We all had furloughs pretty much at the same time, the first couple of weeks of July, came back. And then everybody hadn't had a furlough, got a furlough, even if they had to come here or not. We knew then, of course, we were sending overseas. Mm-hmm. But we didn't really leave Camp Rucker until about the 1st of November. Now, if you think back on the war, we had invaded, D-Day had been in the in June of 44. This was now November of 44. In November, we invaded the Philippine Islands. That looks like things are drawing to a close, but of course, we still had Okinawa and Iwo Jima ahead of us. I remember when we got word we were going overseas, some of them went down to a movie. It was a Sunday afternoon, and a friend of mine said, gee, are they going to send us over there to fight those grown men? We thought of ourselves as pretty young. Yeah, we found out that the Germans were younger. Mm-hmm. So we left Camp Rucker. Now, I'd been in the same platoon since March. We were going to be awfully close friends. Went to New York and were there for about 10 days. Got to New York City three times. Saw three plays. A really great all-black play called it had Hilda Sims in it and Canada Lee. And a kind of a second-rate romantic comedy.
Was that your first time
first time
New York
in New
City?
York, and my first time to see I'd seen a couple of plays at the University of Minnesota, and then high school plays. So, and I went to a third-rate musical called Mexican Hayride.
Where did you stay those 10 days in New York before you
went? Well, we were about 50 miles up the Hudson, Camp Shanks. It was Camp Shanks. We could get a pass any day to in New York in the evening. Mm-hmm. So we were there then in Times Square on election night, 1944, when Roosevelt defeated Dewey by the third term. And it's getting crowded, but we went to a movie and saw To Have and Have Not with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. I can still quote hard passages of that movie. Uh-huh. We really struck it. And came out, and it was after midnight, and Roosevelt had won pretty easily, and the Times Square wasn't as rambunctious as they thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. We went back. 2 days later, we left. It was then, of course, sometime after the 1st of November, we left Alabama. I suppose the election was something like the 7th, and we were on a few days longer, because we were on the ocean on Thanksgiving.
What was the ship like that you were on?
Very small, and we're in the North Atlantic in the early winter, late fall, a pretty stormy place. I came down with seasickness very quickly. Most of us did. I picked up my Thanksgiving dinner and got to where we stood, and they took one look and got out of there. But it was interesting anyway, you know. I'd never seen the ocean before.
Sure. How long were you on the sea?
I think it was 10 days. And then we were in a convoy. Quite a few ships, and there were destroyers that were out there to keep the submarines away from us. And so we landed then in late November in Plymouth, England, which was a pretty exciting thing for me. Literature was one of my interests even then. And to suddenly see a foreign country is something one cannot really describe one's feeling about that, but it was a very unique experience. Got on a train, and took us to a small town, trucks picked us up, then they took us to a little town called Bemister. Our company took over various housing there. We stayed for a month. It was, that was interesting, too, to get to know England. I had read, the last book I read before I went to the Army in Western English was The Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. And I knew we were in Hardy country. One day I was on a detachment to go and pick up ammunition at Dorchester, which is where Hardy had lived, and to bring it back, and I was pretty excited by that. The town called Bemister turns up in a couple of books of Hardy, a couple of novels, as Emister. So we learned about pubs, and we learned about land girls, and we learned about all sorts of things. We went to a card party in the city hall about 3 miles away. Two young women, one pushing a baby carriage, to come by and invite us to come up there. So we walked up to Stoke Abbott. And that's the first time I heard about a very well-kept secret, that is the German V2 bombs that were bombing London. There was no news about that. They didn't want to let the Germans know how successful they were. It was really pretty horrible. There were, after all, 93,000 British civilians killed during the war. So I got a pass to London. I came down on Christmas morning.
That must have been exciting.
Yeah, and they said, you can't go. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to France instead. So we spent Christmas Day then waiting to go. I was in an anti-tank company. We had a 57-millimeter gun, and I was the number two man. I was a loader, and the corporal was the guy that named it, and the sergeant was off to the side telling us who to shoot at. And so we had trucks, which was pretty good, right around trucks. So we waited all that day. We were going to have steak for dinner that day. But we weren't going to have dinner, so they handed out K-rations, and they gave us each a piece of steak, which we then cooked over whatever kind of fire we could make in the street. I remember waiting all that day, all that Christmas day. There was a very pretty young woman who would stand behind the wall area and look at us all the time. She was young. We all speculated as to why she never came out. That day she came out and came over and kissed each of us and went back. it's a kind of a sweet memory.
Uh-huh.
And then we started out for...
Now this was in France?
No, this is still in England.
In England.
And so Christmas Day we started out then for Weymouth, where we'd get our landing craft tanks. And we got there and we heard that one of our ships had been sunk in the day before Christmas Eve, the Leopoldville. And we lost 800 men from our division, all riflemen. Well, we got to most of the night we're on the channel. We got to France, landed at Cherbourg. We were sent out to a little village not far from there and told them to wait. The little boys were there, and I, for the first time in my life, I spoke French using my phrase book. I said, I say, who, you see, would sit down here, and they sat down, and I thought, hey, piece of cake. And we gave them candy and things like that. And we waited, and we started off the next day, and everybody said, see, our French was that bad. They said, well, we heard we're going to Reims. Well, you must remember that the Battle of the Ardennes Forest was then going on. It was called the Battle of the Bulge. It was pretty clear to us we were going to the Battle of the Bulge. But we didn't go to Rennes. We went to Rennes, which is in the middle of Brittany. And so all that day we went through where the Normandy fight had been done to Brittany, came to Rennes. And we stayed there for about 3 days, and then we went down to the front. In Brittany, there were three towns: Saint-Malo, Lorient, Saint-Nazaire, another town south near Bordeaux, where the Germans had not surrendered. They had, when our tanks came through, they came through so fast they couldn't take time with all the prisoners, so some of them just went in. We had, our division was 15,000 men, less than 800 we lost, were detailed to keep the Germans in Lorient and Saint-Nazaire. There were about 90,000 of them. And so that's what we did. We They weren't going to come out. We weren't going to go in, but we had as partners the Free French Army. So on New Year's Eve, we moved down to our, I suppose, our battalion headquarters. And that night on guard, we could see the light of artillery to your artillery, and the next morning we moved into a little farmhouse. Well, our platoon took over this town called Le Temple. And my squad was in a farmhouse about a mile out of town, and the first squad was in three dugouts about a half mile up the road, and the third squad was in a schoolhouse in town. And between us and the Germans, then there were Free French dug in. And New Year's Eve, that New Year's Day, that first night, one of my best friends was in the squad, Barney Johnson, and I were on guard, and the artillery came in. We could hear it creeping up on us, and one hit right behind the house. These were small weapons. They were German 88. They didn't do a lot of damage, but they had to hit something. And I remember Riley and I said, the next one would come right over that house, right on us. And it did, but it went in a ditch right across the road from where we were. And the shrapnel was all around us and knocked some stone off. I said, boy, are we dead? Why didn't we lie down? We knew it was coming, but we didn't. Meanwhile, a whole bunch of shells burst in the dugouts a half mile up the road, and our telephone connection was cut off. We thought they were all dead, probably. But in the morning, here they came, carrying their mess kits down the road, because we ate at our house there. The food would come out late twice a day. Food would come out from the headquarters, and they would come down to eat with us. And we all got the combat infantry badge, which you get for having been under enemy fire or in contact with the enemy. Well, I didn't, neither did Varley. I had to write a thing for the other squad. I wrote a satire, which got to the captain by mistake. He was not terribly amused, but not terribly angry either. I was a little upset that I had shrapnel flying around me. They said, don't worry, you'll get your chance. So we were there 3 weeks. We were a mile out of town, and every day started going to town and buy steaks and bring them back. There was no way for those steaks to get sent anyplace, so we weren't supposed to eat any food in France, but we could eat those. There's a woman butcher. And we came in off guard at midnight or 1 o'clock, whatever, and buy ourselves a steak. It was not bad duty. Right. Not bad duty.
You spoke about staying in this house. Was it an abandoned house?
Yes, everything was. They'd moved out. It hadn't been abandoned really, but it was very close to the French. The Germans were right over there.
Okay.
And so it was a farmhouse, which meant that there was a big room downstairs with a fireplace and a big table. There was a bedroom off to the side where the lieutenant and the company sergeant, the platoon sergeant, were, as well as the medic and the jeep driver. Then upstairs, we were in what was really a haymow, because attached to the house then was the barn.
Mm-hmm.
And the barn had big doors. We kept our guns in there, our guns in our truck, There's one 57-millimeter gun for each squad. So we were there for only 3 weeks. And then we were moved to another part of the front, to a little town called Saint-Omer, which had been totally abandoned, because the Germans were on one side of the canal and we were on the other, and they were living in dugouts. And during the day, we could go into the town or hang around in that orchard which we had. And in town, there were lots of houses to explore. There were a million gallons of wine, but nobody ever dared take it. It was in big barrels, and they were filled with poison. And there was nobody there. The week before we had arrived, our cannon company, our artillery, I put an observation booth in the spire of the church. And the day it was finished, the church was blown up by Germans who had come through carrying, we were told, sea mines, and it just put them there, blown into all the pieces. So, you know, when we realized that the day we came in, all of our places were fired on. And they'd gone after that church. They had, in other words, they had a good spy system. There were a lot of Frenchmen who were collaborating. So we were there for 3 weeks. we had a dugout, and then we had a passageway from the dugout to another small area. That's where we stayed on guard at night to watch, see if anybody's going to come up. There was artillery most nights that came over us and hit, who knows what they were shooting. Apparently they had plenty of shells and they kept shooting. I know, when I talk about the kind of information the Germans had, back in the old farmhouse, some of us decided we'd go out and practice shooting our guns. We weren't exactly a priority sector. We were issued seven shells for our weapons each week. I carried a pistol, which is what you did if you loaded the cannon. And they handed out rifles to everybody, but I was someplace else, so I carried that pistol, which was very easy to carry, of course. Mm-hmm. But we decided we'd go out and shoot it. We'd found a can, go out and put up against a haystack and shoot. First thing we know, we were being fired upon by, we thought it was the biggest shell that the Germans had. The kind they use for their coastal defense. It came, as they always say in books, it sounded like a freight train coming. And it did before we got back to our place in a hurry. So, in the evening then, it was, you know, there was not any snow there all that winter. Or if there was, there was very little. It went very quickly. We'd stand outside our dugouts before we got back in. We'd watch the Germans across the canal quite a ways off. We could shoot at them if we wanted to, but nobody ever wanted to. It didn't seem to, it seemed too cold-blooded. I mean, we all assumed if we charged anybody, we would shoot like mad. Mm-hmm. Or if they charged us, we would shoot. They sit there doing target practice as a human being. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever fired a gun. I thought that would be good. Mm-hmm. So after 3 weeks, we went back on reserve.
So these Germans you were watching, they were just content watching you two?
Well, I don't think they wanted to draw any fire on themselves. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't see as well as we could see them. I think we were in that orchard. Okay. They're a long way off. Okay. While we were out there one day, I got my pass to London, only this time it was to Paris. Mm-hmm. So I went to Paris for 4 days, along with my platoon commander, Lieutenant Price.
That must have been exciting.
It was really exciting. I saw everything in Paris one should see. I mean, I took a tour. I saw an army review. I saw a play put on by the USO. I went to the Folies Bergères. Notre Dame, everything. The Louvre. Napoleon's tomb. I saw it all. It was a cold, cold, desolate winter, of course. Everybody was cold. And, of course, back in our dugout, it was warm. And we could read at night because Barney Johnson, my friend, who was a genius of sorts, figured out a way to mix kerosene and Calvados, which is apple brandy. It would make a beautiful light to read by.
Mm. Wouldn't that draw attention to you, though?
Not in the dugout.
Okay. How deep is the dugout?
Well, they're deep enough, so...
Oh, okay.
There were logs around, and it was all covered with dirt, and nobody could see anything in there.
That's good.
On the way back from Paris, the captain said, boy, that roof, the lieutenant said, that roof, pig out, or... The Pig Alley is really something. That's a Rue Pigalle, which is where all the bars and the prostitutes were. And I said, Pig Alley, I don't know. You mean you didn't go to Big Galley? No, I didn't. He said, what the hell did you do? And I told him. I thought he was disappointed in me. I spent my, what I had done, I bought a bunch of books, including the novel of Henry Miller, who could not be published in the United States. But one of my friends in our poetry club back in University of Nebraska had said, if you get to France, make sure you buy Henry Miller's books. So, now, I've never seen anything like that. I remember lying in our bunk, which we had dug out in the walls of the dugout one night, and I said, listen to this, and I read a passage that was incredibly obscene, and I remember a fellow said, that ain't in no book, you just made that up. I said, have you ever heard me swear? Which I didn't do, we were quite good about swearing. So we went back to a town called Blenn, which is the town we went to once a week to get a shower, in an army shower unit. And we stayed in a big country house near a bunch of old castles and long abandoned, I think. And we played a lot of touch football. And our platoon commander, a platoon sergeant, broke his leg playing football. So our sergeant, squad sergeant, was moved up to take his place. And while we were there, we got our first passes. We went to now the city of about 1 million people on the seacoast. And oh man, just think, we're going to go in the USO and the Red Cross Club. Well, there wasn't any USO and there wasn't any Red Cross Club. The Forgotten Front, of course. Now, back in England, shortly before Christmas, we read in the Army newspaper that the big hit, number one, the hit parade was Don't Fence Me In. Don't Fence Me In. What in the world kind of song is that? We had lived, as my generation did with the hit parade. We had defined ourselves, our romance, everything with songs in the hit parade for all those years before. And here is a song the hit parade didn't know, and we were wild to find out what it was all about. But we didn't know, we couldn't find out. So we went into, we listened to the radio in England, but we never heard it. When we got our first pass to Nantes, we went down to, into town, there was no Red Cross Club. We went to bars, there was no music. De Gaulle said no music. France is free until evening, you see, no music today. And nobody played Don't Fence Me In to us. Went to the opera one night. It was a Tuesday night, which meant we couldn't stay for the end of it. Rigoletto, we had to leave early because the road we went on back to where we were stationed was bombarded at about midnight every Tuesday night. So we went back. Yeah. I remember that. How in the world did Rigoletto end? How does it end? And somebody said, well, I got another question, how did it begin? We couldn't figure out any of it. It was a glorious experience anyway. And we found one place where they would serve us food. We weren't supposed to do that, but they gave us fried eggs and fried potatoes. Well, there was plenty of that around, and they couldn't ship it to Paris where the people were. And then we wasted our time in the brothels on the waterfront, which, let me tell you, we were a very moral group. Nobody ever went upstairs with a girl, but we had no other place to go. And they put up with it pretty well. We left huge tips. We'd play. We didn't drink much either. We were a very abstemious group. Boy, what a bunch of, well, we were 1930s boys. That's what we were. I remember playing, we put all your chairs around and pour one away.
Oh, sure.
What's that called? Oh, well. Anyway.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I just can't.
Anyway, they turned the phonograph, and there we were. I just knocked that all down. There we were. And there's a dwarf who worked there, standing on the table, just. We'd all run for the chairs. Well, I never told my mother about that. It didn't seem to be the sort of thing she would be interested in. But she wouldn't have thought it amazing. Nobody ever went upstairs with a woman there. But it's part of our experience. Then we moved to another place, and still on reserve, and some of us were sent out to guard the general's house. And what do you know, there was a U.S. show in the next town. So we divided ourselves very carefully into those who could sing and those who couldn't. And those of us who could sing went to the afternoon thing to have them sing Don't Fence Me In. It had been canceled.
Oh.
So that evening, the ones who couldn't sing went over. And they all came back and said, we heard Don't Fence Me In. Sing it. Sing it again, Sam. And they couldn't. They couldn't sing it, so we didn't know. And then one day, it came out, and the Army hit kid. So it was, that's what my favorite pop song of all time. It took so long to hear.
Don't Fence Me In.
Okay. Oh, give me land, lots of land.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really great song. And
sure.
Of course, it was written by Cole Porter, of all people.
Oh, yeah.
It was part of a movie called Hollywood Canteen. Well, then we went on reserve in another place, Plurimel, which is interesting. The last big nightly pageant battle between knights. It was Professor Shopi who was held at Plurimel. And that's where we were when we heard that Roosevelt had died. We didn't know if that's around it. Tents, and we had a big tent then, and most of us cried the day when we went down to in the town, and the Frenchmen kept telling us how sorry they were. And then it was decided that we should send somebody down to guard some prisoners, so 10 of us went down, my friends and I went down to, they call it Bricaback, no, that was, you know, it's in the town not far away, where there were some 100 German prisoners who were kept in the stockade, and they were the railhead for our quartermaster company. So they would work, and we would guard them. We had our tent right outside. And that was interesting, very interesting. We were right on the big canal, and I would walk along the canal. I remember I was reading what's happened in my mind? An English writer, Carlyle, I guess, on power and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how interesting to be guarding the Germans there.
Yeah.
Well, we went back. Barney Johnson hadn't come with us. Barney, you see, was known as Sad Sack because Sad Sack was a cartoon character, mm-hmm. just like Barney. He had never shaved very closely, couldn't, he had acne face, he was thin, he was hunched over. His clothes looked like he had gone with the Salvation Army, but he was maybe the best soldier I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
And could do anything, play the harmonica. And we'd been close together, you know, for a year. And on the way back, the driver said, hey, Sad Sack got transferred out. And he thought that was funny, because if you didn't know Sad Sack, you kind of thought he might be in jail. And then the guy looked back and we were all crying, you know. he was our friend.
Break up the group, yeah.
Yeah.
Where did he end up going?
He was, because he was as good as he was taken into a tank company to repair tanks. They needed somebody, and, you know, without a computer, they could still spot him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, see, I told you that one of the friends in our poetry organization called the Ezra Pound E.E. Cummings Poetry Club. We even had a thing that we all signed. Paul Murphy, who became a constitutional lawyer, he didn't go overseas. And when I met down at the university, I said, you know, whatever happened to you, Paul? He said, well, they wanted somebody who could play the piano and type. I got transferred out and sent to an officer's club someplace where I typed all day and played the piano in the officer's club at night. No. He really felt he'd been cheated. Uh-huh. A lot of his friends went down on that ship, including, I said, one of our people got killed in Hawaii. He went down on that ship. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, walking in the cemetery above Omaha Beach, there were these, all these people were buried there with their names. And then along the wall, there were the plaques of people missing in action, and whose plaque was. Well, something terrible happened to me.
What was that?
I had to go back and guard more prisoners. And this time, they started out by going through some sort of a roster. So my friends and I, this time, they started at the top of the roster. I started at the bottom of the roster. I don't know how people were assigned. And I went to the top. I was the guy at the top. So I was there with 12 guys I didn't much care for. They were okay, but they weren't my friends.